Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning and a happy Friday. It's the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Kai Wright, host of WNYC's podcast, The United States of Anxiety, and I'm sitting in for Brian today. Thanks for joining me. Lots to talk about today. We've got the Supreme Court. We've got the latest in our daily Trusha updates. The president does not have tapes after all. And we'll talk about the challenges families and law enforcement face when seniors go missing. But we start with the hugely important policy story out of Washington this week. Yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell finally let the rest of the country see the stealth care bill that he and a small group of Republicans have been crafting. As expected, the bill landed like a cluster bomb in this political climate. Democrats immediately argued that McConnell was a hypocrite after 7 years of accusing Democrats of shoving the Affordable Care Act through Congress unilaterally. Here is what Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor said right after McConnell revealed the bill.
The debate over health care has been fierce. We know that the Republicans and Democrats had differences when we debated the Affordable Care Act. At least we had a debate. At least we had committee hearings and a process.
Later in the day, former President Obama also weighed in with a lengthy Facebook post. He called the bill, quote, a massive transfer of wealth from middle class and poor families to the richest people in America. And he said it, quote, had a fundamental meanness at its core. McConnell, for his part, says that there will be ample time to debate and amend the bill, but he reportedly also wants a vote by the end of the week. So you do the math on ample time. So there is a lot to consider over the next 7 days or so. We will do our best between now and then to try to at least understand what our representatives are going to be asked to vote for. And so to help me go through that here today, we have Mary Agnes Carey from Kaiser Health News. Hi, Mary.
Hi there.
And we have Elizabeth Benjamin, who is Vice President for Health Initiatives at the Community Service Society of New York. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi, Kai.
Hello. So I want to particularly focus on Medicaid this morning because it seems to me we talk a lot about the individual market. And, you know, that's important. This is, again, for listeners, people who are buying insurance themselves instead of getting it from an employer. But Medicaid is massive. And the proposals under both the House and the Senate bills would change it dramatically. I think most listeners probably know that Medicaid is the publicly financed, government-run insurance provider for low-income and disabled Americans. But a lot of people may not know that it insures one in five Americans. One in five Americans and two-thirds of people who are in nursing homes are covered by Medicaid. So it's a big deal. And why don't we start, Mary, with what's in the bill, what's in the Senate bill on Medicaid, just the top lines of what it would do.
The biggest shift is in how the federal government would fund the Medicaid program. Right now, it's funded on a percentage basis. It's a match basis. On average, the federal government pays about 57% of the cost of Medicaid in states. But what would happen is in a few years from now, it would go to a fixed set of money. States would no longer be matched on what they spend. It would no longer be an open entitlement. And not only would that money be limited, but after about 2025, it would grow at the rate of general inflation, not medical inflation. And that's a big concern because if states don't have the same amount of money, they're going to have to make a few decisions. Do they cut enrollment? Do they reduce benefits? Do they reduce provider payments? And the providers, or the doctors and the hospitals and all those who care for those in Medicaid. So as you mentioned, with Medicaid paying nearly two-thirds of nursing home care, half the births of this country, a considerable number of children, for example, in this country, states that have to have other big-ticket items like education or prisons, they have to go in there and figure out what they're going to do on less. And that is the big fundamental change in the entitlement nature of Medicaid that is being contemplated in the Senate bill, and it's also in the House bill.
And I want to get later into the real details there of some of those choices that states face. But so first off, comparing the Senate and the House bill on this sort of block granting of Medicaid and how much the federal government will continue to contribute to it, the Senate bill is actually more restrictive than the House bill. Is that correct?
It is in the sense of how much they're going to give the states. The one thing that the Senate bill does that's different from the House bill is they gradually, more gradually, it's like over a 3 to 4 year period, they phase out states that expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. The federal government covered most of the cost of those individuals that were under that expansion. So that's going to be phased out over about a 3 to 4 year period. But again, when they give that states that lump sum of money, the House bill is medical inflation plus, I believe, additional percentage point on top of that to try to keep up with the growing costs of Medicaid and the growing health care costs, which are always higher than general inflation. But the Senate bill would limit that after 2025 to standard inflation, not medical inflation. And so that's where states are looking at this and will be making this decision and looking at it. What's going to happen to us after 2025? How much less money will we have to work on? Not only is the matching going away for every dollar we spend, but that lump sum that we'll get will not grow perhaps with the cost of medical costs. And so that's really a big difference there.
Right. And so, Elizabeth, thinking about this for New Yorkers, there are 31 states have expanded Medicaid. New York and New Jersey were both amongst them under the Affordable Care Act. Looking at the Senate bill, what are you thinking about for New Yorkers at this moment?
Well, for New York, instead of calling it the Better Care Reconciliation Act, they should have called it the Poorer Care Reconciliation Act, because everyone's going to be a lot poorer. And let me tell you why. First of all, on the Medicaid front, that we expect around 2.7 million to have been, you know, have their coverage threatened under the House bill. We now know that will be worse for New York under the, shall we call it, the Poorer Care Act. People will be poor because the Senate bill seeks to eliminate coverage for immigrants who are here lawfully. As a result of the Affordable Care Act, New York State was able to get lots of Medicaid funding and basic health plan funding and was able to provide coverage to over 350,000 immigrants. We believe that these immigrants' health coverage will be severely jeopardized because for the 176,000 that used to be on state-only funded Medicaid, there's no longer federal funding, and so they're going to be, you know, possibly in very bad situation.
So listeners got that. That's a lot, and that seems important. I don't want to blow by. So you're saying that there is 176,000 or so New Yorkers who are immigrants who were able to be funded through state-only
They used to have state-only funded Medicaid dollars. Under the Affordable Care Act, we were able to get federal funding for them. Their care, their coverage will now have to be entirely funded by the state again.
And so did the number of people expand then as a consequence? Were there more than 176,000 immigrant New Yorkers who were then able to get?
Yes, more than 176,000, because not only that, we were able to take advantage of the basic health plan option, which is another provision of the Affordable Care Act, and extend coverage to even more immigrants all the way up to 200% of poverty. Not only that, lawful immigrants, not all, but people, for example, who've gotten a green card in the last 5 years will no longer be able to access the marketplace and get subsidies through the marketplace or access Medicaid unless our state comes up with the state-only funding again. On top of that, the quality of coverage under the new Better Care, Poorer Care Reconciliation Act will also be worse. Instead of taking it to a sort of modest plan, what they called a silver plan, which had where the insurance company paid 70% roughly and you paid 30%, they're now pegging it to something that's less than a bronze plan. So when you talk to people about what's wrong with the Affordable Care Act, they say the deductibles are too high and I don't get enough subsidies. This, in fact, makes the deductibles much higher and will give you less subsidies. And on top of that, you know, older people are also particularly affected by this, people over 55, and I'm sure Mary can get into the details on that. Okay. So, you know, from my perspective and from New York's perspective, this bill is even worse than the House bill. And that's sort of a shocker because we thought the Senate, and in fact, many of our Republican representatives said, well, the Senate's going to clean this up, and that's why we're voting for this. And I would like them to tell us how this makes it better for New York, because it's worse.
Mary, is that the conversation in Washington? I had the same thought, is that, you know, there was a lot of conversation during the House vote. Some of the people who felt like they were holding their nose and voting for it said, some of the Republicans said, well, you know, we'll fix this with the Senate. But it seems like the bill has gotten, has gone further to the right.
Well, that's precisely the calculation. Mitch McConnell's trying to figure what can he do. He's the Senate Majority Leader, to appease conservatives, to get them on the bill, to take care of Senate moderates, to get them on the bill. And right now, both those camps appear to be extremely unhappy with it. Senate conservatives, Ted Cruz or Rand Paul, thinks it's Obamacare light. Moderates like Susan Collins of Maine or Lisa Murkowski of Alaska are very upset about not only the Medicaid changes, but also this idea that Planned Parenthood would not be funded for a year. They're very concerned about that. Elizabeth hit an excellent point about how, with the subsidy structure, some individuals may be asked to pay more for less because the plans won't have to be as generous. There's also an ability in the Senate bill, while they say, and it's written in the bill, that pre-existing conditions must be covered, states can get a waiver from this thing called essential health benefits. These are a package of benefits like maternity care and prescription drugs and mental health that states could go for waivers where plans wouldn't have to cover that. So
these are the things that Obamacare introduced, that this is what the insurance plan, insurance plans must now have.
In the Affordable Care Act, the essential health benefits, everybody, all these plans have to cover it. If you can get an exemption, if plans can get an exemption to not cover those things, that is sort of a backdoor way of getting at a pre-existing medical condition. If I don't cover maternity care, nobody's going to be having a baby on my health insurance plan.
Listeners, we are talking about the new Senate bill unveiled yesterday to repeal and replace Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. We're talking with Mary Agnes Cagney of Kaiser Health News and Elizabeth Benjamin of the Community Service Society of New York. If you have questions, you're trying to figure out what's going on with this bill, what's the latest, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And Mary, let's do a bit of a whip count here in terms of what Mitch McConnell needs to pass the bill. So he needs 50 votes with the vice president. They've got 52 seats. There are, first off, thinking about the folks that he's got to balance on the right that you're talking about. There are four senators, four all guys, who have said they don't want to vote for it yet. Ted Cruz, Mike Lee of Utah, Rand Paul of Texas, and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Sounds like Rand Paul is the most firm on that. No, what is going to be offered to move those four?
Well, that's the key point, right? Because they said they were against it, but they were open to negotiation. So here's the question for me. Are they looking for something in particular for their states? Do they want other changes in the subsidy structure? Do they want more flexibility for states? There's a provision in this Senate bill that is giving money to states to try to help, for example, insurers with high-cost cases. Would they want some variance in state grants to allow more flexibility? They probably want lots of flexibility for states to do what they want to do. So that's precisely the issue for the conservatives, that they're going to be, I mean, I think when you say in a public press statement, we're open to negotiation, they're just saying what a lot of lawmakers will be doing this week. Mitch McConnell's going to have Republican lawmakers, I'm sure, in and out of his office that are going to be asking for particular money, maybe carve-outs for states, particular money, particular deals, to try to get to that magic number, as you noted, for 50, because Vice President Mike Pence can come in and cast that tiebreaker. So it's just a simple majority.
And what about the moderates? So we've heard that these four on the far right are like, nope, we're not doing it. We have some questions from the moderates. There are several of them, but they haven't said they're not voting for it. It seems like two particularly important states here are West Virginia and Ohio. Rob Portman in Ohio,
right,
and Shelley Moore Capito in West Virginia. Why those two? Why are those states important?
Well, they both have expanded Medicaid, and the Medicaid expansion covers a significant number of people in both those states. And in any state that's expanded Medicaid, that additional money has helped fund opioid addiction treatment. And there's right now about $2 billion in that bill to do it, but most experts would tell you that's certainly not enough, and it certainly won't stack up when states no longer get that additional money for people if they expanded under Medicaid. So that has been a big problem for both of those senators. And so that is a question, because if you want to give states more money for Medicaid, particular expansion states, it's going to raise the cost of the bill. And so that's another concern for the moderates, or I beg your pardon, for the conservatives, who don't like it now because it's Obamacare light, and they sure wouldn't want to make it any more expensive.
Elizabeth, let me play you a clip from Chuck Schumer yesterday on the Senate floor after he heard, this is after Mitch McConnell introduced the bill, and this is the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer trying to give an idea of the impact.
Somewhere in America, Mr. President, there's a family who takes a trip each Friday to visit grandma or grandpa at a nursing home, who sacrificed all of their savings to pay for their health care until they had no more savings, and now relies on Medicaid to help pay the cost of long-term care in the nursing home. Somewhere in America, there's a parent whose child has cancer, a mother and father who stay up late at night, worried that their insurance will either not be available or run out when the family needs it most.
So, you know, this might be the kind of thing that has the president mocking Chuck Schumer as crying Chuck, you know, but the politics of it aside, I mean, he's clearly, there's some theater there, but these two scenarios he's pointing to really are a lot of what's at stake with Medicaid in particular, right? Like, talk to me about the nursing homes piece of it and how crucial Medicaid is to nursing home funding here, at least here in New York, but elsewhere.
Oh, I mean, it's huge. The Medicaid piece for nursing home coverage, long-term care coverage, is huge. I mean, I think Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer, our great senator from the great state of New York, is absolutely right. This, you know, Poor Care Reconciliation Act will actually incentivize a race to the bottom. So if states offer less coverage, they will be rewarded. Therefore, you will see people being thrown out of nursing homes or refused to be admitted to nursing homes. It's going to upend the whole healthcare industry. The Commonwealth Fund says, you know, even the AHCA, the House bill, was a job killer. That's exactly what's going to happen in New York and many other states if this bill is enacted.
But is that
so
really,
I mean, a huge problem for us?
On this image of people being thrown out of nursing homes, is that, I mean, in all seriousness, is that what people would be facing, or are there other options?
I mean, 644,000 seniors in New York alone depend on Medicaid. A huge portion of them are on long-term care. If there's not enough money, who's going to pay? I mean, maybe people won't be thrown out, but I bet they will be, because I don't see, if the states are incentivized to cut Medicaid, you know, either there just isn't enough money. The magnitude of money that they are seeking to wrest out of the system is so enormous that there will not be enough money to cover all the seniors that need long-term care. No way.
And let's do talk about what states would actually face. For listeners who don't know, Medicaid is, for most states, it's right up there with K-12 education in terms of the size of state budget. It is a huge expense. Absent the federal funding, it will certainly certainly be very difficult for states to fill that gap. So what all can they do, either of you, Mary, say these bills pass?
There's horrible choices. I mean, it's, what are you going to do? You're going to cover your kids? You're going to cover your pregnant women? You're going to cover your people with disabilities? Or you're going to cover your seniors? Something's got to give. And that's who's in Medicaid.
Well, you could raise taxes.
You know, it's like horrible, draconian choices will have to be made if either of these bills go through.
Yes, it's cutting and reason cut enrollments. You might cut benefits. You might reduce the amount of money you pay to the medical providers to take care of these folks. I mean, we've got to remember, we've got 10 to 11,000 people a day aging into the Medicare program. As those folks age, especially that group of people 85 and higher, they tend to get much more expensive. So maybe states would grandfather current enrollment in nursing homes at that level when it starts to, you know, as the funding starts to drop, but then they could set up completely different, you know, people who could qualify for the benefits and what has to happen and what they have to contribute. I mean, Elizabeth's right. It's this trade-off of choices that states, because states won't be able to make up this funding shortfall. They're just not going to be able to do it. Now, Republicans will talk a lot about flexibility, Currently in the Medicaid program, governors can apply to the federal government, a state governor, to come up with a different way to implement the Medicaid program, and they're very different as you go from state to state. Republicans will say that more flexibility at the local level will help them to manage this. But in the House bill alone, the Medicaid cut was $840 billion over a decade. The fact that they are changing the formula here to fund Medicaid after 2025, to putting it back to general inflation, may very well mean that Medicaid is even cut more severely over the next decade. We'll probably find that out early next week when the Congressional Budget Office, or what we like to call it, the CBO, comes out with its score of this bill to explain the monetary impacts, the impact on Medicaid, the impact on the exchanges, that sort of thing.
What about this idea that has circulated even before we got to repeal, that was a number of Republican governors were looking at for how they would expand Medicaid? Mike Pence, I think, pioneered the idea in Indiana of, you know, cost sharing with Medicaid enrollees, with that, you know, that where you have to start paying a copay, you have to start paying coinsurance, different varying ways to sort of get enrollees to pay in. Could that help with would those ideas help with the budget shortfall?
I mean, the idea of skin in the game is something that is very much appeals to conservatives. But if you're requiring a copay or money out of people is, I think, a very small foot on the scale, if you will, compared to a big drop in the federal government funding.
Yeah. Let's try to take some calls. Michael in Harlem, welcome. You are on the air.
Yes, good morning. I would just like to state that I'm in my apartment in Harlem, and I'm absolutely terrified. I mean, I was almost crying last night. I'm disabled. I'm 57 years of age. My doctors and all of my help are at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. So I don't know what's going to happen. I'm on Medicare at the moment, and people say, "Oh, you're on Medicare. Everything's great. You know, you get so much money." Not true. I'm dual eligible, which means I get Medicare and Medicaid, because I really, after all of my Medicare payments from the federal, my money's per day to live on is $22 a day. So I'm dual eligible. I have my health with Health First, and the managed plan I have with Health First is very specific. I can only have this plan if I'm dual eligible, both Medicare and Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Every year in January, I have to then apply again for Medicaid. So in 2018, I'm terrified that it will be switched off. If it's switched off, I can no longer see my doctors. I can no longer go to therapy. I can no longer have operations. I can no longer do anything. And then if I have to start buying in my $22 a day, that then might dip down to $14 a day. Who can live on $14 or less dollars a day? Medicaid is vital for me to stay alive in New York. And as far as I'm concerned, the 1% should be ashamed of themselves.
Michael,
how many houses do they need in the Hamptons and Aspen and all of these places? And that's where the money is going to. And I think it's about time that the people rise up peacefully, not violently, and have another 60s revolution, but without
Michael,
the drugs and without the flowers in the hair. But
okay,
people need to rise up and say, you,
Michael,
the 1%, cannot take everything from this country.
Michael, let me ask Elizabeth about your situation. So for
sure,
someone like Michael, who is, as he says, he sits there, he's terrified about when he has to reapply, that he what is the likely situation under this bill for someone like Michael?
Well, the good news for Michael is that in all scenarios, both bills are phasing in the horrible things they plan to do. So he shouldn't worry about this for next year. But number two, in New York, we're really lucky because our state has decided to set up a consumer assistance program that helps people just like Michael with their recertification or getting onto Medicaid if they have Medicare and they have low income and they need to have both programs, or with any kind of recertification if they get a denied service under their health insurance company. We can help you with their appeals, and that number is 888-614-5400. It's called Community Health Advocates. It's your New York State Managed Care Health Insurance Ombuds Program. You don't have to have managed care. You don't have to have insurance at all. If you need help finding insurance, we can also get you sorted in that direction as well. So, you know, it's 888-614-5400. 5,400 community health advocates were there to help you. So, Michael, you should sleep at night. It is enraging, I agree, and I don't think I'm pretty mad, too, as everybody can probably tell. But for you, starting in January, you're going to be okay. It's the phase-out that we're really worried about and the incredible budget pressures that New York is going to be under, and that's what we are really worried about. We have to fight, and you're absolutely right. We have to get, don't get sad, get organized, get mad.
So thanks for calling, Michael. Michael's call has me thinking, Mary, also about the other part of Chuck Schumer's quote there, where, you know, he talked about nursing homes, but he also talked about the opioid crisis. This is certainly, I mean, again, going back to Ohio and West Virginia and Senator Rob Portman and Senator Shelley Moore Capito, who are, you know, question marks on this. Ohio and West Virginia have, I believe they're with New Hampshire, of the three states with the highest rate of overdose from this opioid crisis that we're all talking about, and that was by a lot of reporting clearly seems to have played a role in the election too, in some of these rural and exurban counties that felt like America really needed to be made great again. They were looking around, seeing this crisis and seeing no one's responding to it. How much is that part of this debate for those two senators? Does the opioid crisis show up, and is that going to influence their vote?
I think it will, because there is a, as you noted, this is the opioid addiction, the opioid crisis is a huge problem for them. It has become more and more of a problem all across the country, as we've had all these issues with public health, with addiction to prescription painkillers and so on. And so I do think that they have made this clear, especially in West Virginia and Ohio. Those are two key states that both Senator Moore Capito and Senator Portman are going to be going to Mitch McConnell and saying the $2 billion that you have in this bill for opioid treatment is just not going to cut it. It's not enough money. And so do they have – the key is, do you try to raise that particular fund overall, right? Would Senator McConnell try to put more money into that for all the states? Because it while we're talking about these particular two or three that we're mentioning, it is widespread across the country. So, and you've got to remember, too, that once the Senate does its work on the bill, it's got to be reconciled with a House version, and the House has some different approaches to this. So that's something that Senator McConnell's got to look at. Does he do what they call a carve-out, where they do a special provision in a bill to say the state of Ohio will receive this or the state of West Virginia will receive that? That tends to not go over too well because the other senators don't care for it. But I think that is something Senator McConnell may have very well started intentionally with this lower funding, knowing that that's going to bring Shelley Moore Capito and Rob Portman to the table to try to get more money for that particular provision, which they have talked about is incredibly important to them.
So you mean that he would sort of specifically sort of set this up so that they would have something to negotiate for and then be able to vote yes?
Maybe. You know, it's something that they want. That they would want to be taken care of. But I think we can't underscore enough the discomfort that they and other senators may have with the overall Medicaid funding structure. About 31 states in the District of Columbia have expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, right? That allowed people up to $16,000 of income to get on Medicaid, and the federal government was going to cover, it tapered down from 100 down to 90% of costs in perpetuity for those folks. That is the concern about people on the Medicaid expansion. They've got these folks on the Medicaid expansion. People in Medicaid typically churn. They're sort of on and then they're off. If they were an expansion person, they got a job, their income went up, they get back on Medicaid, they're going to be at the regular match rate. Not the higher match rate, but the point being the states are going to have to do more with less money, and that is going to be difficult for a lot of senators, just not the ones we're talking about here.
But what's the end game here is part of what I want to understand. Is there any possible way that either of you can imagine, Mary, you particularly in Washington, that somehow we would arrive at a place where there is a bipartisan bill, where that that this bill would not pass and that we would then have to negotiate something for it? Or would we just go back to Obamacare and everything would move on? I mean, where do we go from here as politically?
I think, you know, the Democrats have sent signals, and none of this is happening at this point, so I want to be clear. But Democrats have said repeatedly, if Republicans will stop talking about repealing the Affordable Care Act, they say they really want to get in there and make changes and honestly work at some of the problems that exist. The current subsidy structure under the Affordable Care Act, some people want to change. The way it's constructed, you have people in states that didn't do Medicaid expansion. They don't qualify for the subsidies. It's kind of technical, but that's like 2.5 million people that don't have coverage. Democrats have said, if you want to work on this, let's work on it. But that the discourse in Washington is nowhere near that. You know, when Mitch McConnell... Oh, go ahead, please.
Go ahead, Elizabeth.
No, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just going to say there's other, like, Republican ideas or, you know, free market ideas that they could also do that are, I would think, very attractive that would really stabilize markets. If we just pivot a bit for a moment away from Medicaid, there's all sorts of reinsurance and risk adjustment, you know, behind the scenes funding for the insurance companies that could stabilize their markets. I think there's a real need to rethink how to design some insurance packages for younger people that make it more attractive so we have better risk in the markets. I think there's lots of things that we could talk about that would be highly palatable to, you know, both sides of the aisle, and we need to just get to a place where people, reasonable health policy experts, are at the table. I think the thing that's so shocking and upsetting about what Washington's doing right now is that there wasn't one person in the healthcare industry or one consumer healthcare advocate that believes in either of these bills has any kind of merit. So the American Medical Association against it, the American Hospital Association against it, American Cancer Society, American Diabetes Association, Families USA, Communities Catalyst, Consumers Union. No one has come out in favor of either of these bills or anything like it. That's a problem.
I mean, to that point, we have a tweet from one listener, Bob Lesser, says, stop wrestling with their GOP minutia. Their plan is to crush all New Deal programs. I think we do have to wrestle with the minutia, but and this is a great society, Lyndon Johnson era program, not New Deal program. But the point being that there's an ideological battle here as opposed to a specific kind of health policy battle.
And if they really want tax cuts, figure out a way to give people tax cuts. But don't do it at the expense of low-income, disabled, seniors, children, and, you know, providers, healthcare providers. That's not the way to, you know, pass tax cuts.
We're basically out of time, but I want to try to squeeze in just one more call. Mary Ann from Pompton Plains, New Jersey. Mary Ann, hi, you're on the air. Quickly, tell us about your story.
And I don't know if the experts are able to answer this question. I have a pre-existing condition. I know pre-existing conditions will be retained. So does two of other members in my family. We all have chronic illnesses. My question is, the ACA had retained or actually changed policies so that there would be no lifetime maximums on insurance policies. I don't know if this is addressed in the new bill. Are they going to retain that, or are they going to reinstitute the lifetime maximums on policies, which, you know, for my family and many others, you know, is absolutely devastating. I could be out of insurance in 2 years.
The House bill definitely reinstituted the ability to impose lifetime and annual caps. And Mary, I don't know. I didn't get that far in the Senate bill yet. Do you know the answer?
No, but here's my guess. Because part of the reason that happened in the House bill is because states were allowed to have variance, get a waiver on some of those essential health benefits we talked about, those required benefits. Those are tied to the caps. So I think if you can get a waiver, and I have to fact check myself to be very honest here with your listeners, but I believe that was the issue in the House. If you were allowed to get a waiver from those required benefits, that impacted the essential, the lifetime and the annual limit. So, and I have read other analyses this morning where experts in this were saying that the insurers would be allowed to waive those limits, but that is something I was actually going to research myself today. So please keep your eye on KaiserHealth.org.
The other thing I just wanted to say is that's not just for Affordable Care Act plans or Obamacare plans. That's true for commercial coverage too. So that's really a
those
big
rules
risk
that were
to all of us.
Those rules that were instituted, that it was, it's for the whole market.
So that's one of the, I think people forget that the Affordable Care Act help people in job-based coverage too get better consumer protections.
And
Well, Mary, I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. We are out of time, but I think this is exactly the kind of thing we're talking about in terms of, will there be enough time to figure out what's all in this bill and what it will mean before we have a vote expectedly by the end of next week. Thanks to Mary Agnes Carey from Kaiser Health News and Elizabeth Benjamin from the Community Service Society of New York. I'm Kai Wright, host of WNYC's podcast, The United States of Anxiety, sitting in for Brian Lehrer today. Up next, what happens when seniors go missing in New York City? Stay with us.